This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After working together on the films Ocean's 11, 12, and 13, my guests Matt Damon and director Steven Soderbergh have made the new film The Informant. It premiered last weekend at the Toronto Film Festival and opens nationally this weekend. It's adapted from a book of investigative journalism about a price-fixing conspiracy involving the agribusiness company ADM. The book also investigates the ADM executive who blew the whistle and alerted the FBI to the scheme. That whistleblower had his own secrets, and what he told the FBI wasn't always true. Damon stars as that not always reliable whistleblower, Mark Whitaker. Unlike the book, the movie has an ironic, often comic tone. Let's start with a scene. Whitaker has been working with the FBI undercover while continuing his job at ADM. The feds have made their first bust, and none of Whitaker's colleagues have figured out he's the informant. He's intoxicated by playing the role of spy, even though he sometimes unknowingly bungles the job. He's with the two FBI agents he's been working with, played by Scott Bakula and Joel McHale. They're talking about the bust.
That was amazing. You guys should have seen it. Oh, Terry was so scared, and Mick and the lawyers, they were pissed.
Yeah, that's super, Mark.
And the best part is, they thought you guys gave me the once-over.
Who did you tell?
What?
Who else did you tell about the raid?
Well, I had to tell my secretary.
Guys, I'm the head of the bioproducts division. You know, she has to know where to get in touch with me. I told her months ago. So all I said was, Liz, I'm doing some work with the FBI. I might be out of touch for a while. That's it. She had no idea about our case. I'm pretty sure I've mentioned the name Kathy Doherty a time or two. She is a trusted ally, and I didn't want her to be scared.
Why did you do that, Mark?
I trust her. Guys, we can trust Kathy.
Who else? Don't jack us around, Mark.
Kirk Schmidt. You Schmitty?
Matt Damon, Steven Soderbergh, welcome back to Fresh Air. Steven Soderbergh, the movie starts with a disclaimer that says basically these characters are all composites, and the disclaimer ends with, so there. What's the so there supposed to be there for?
I stole that actually from a movie called Airplane that came out in 1980. At the very end of the crawl in the film,
they put that there
at the end. I've always wanted to steal it. And I that was a card that was going to be, in our case, at the end of the film. And I moved it up front because I really wanted to remind everyone that this was a true story, because at a certain point it becomes so absurd that I thought people might not remember that it was true.
So the so there was to remind us that it was true, not to remind us that you took liberties.
Yes, exactly. And also, it's kind of a mood setter.
Yeah, it sets the mood.
Well, speaking of the mood is ironic as opposed to investigative journalism. We're inside the character that Matt Damon plays, Mark Whitaker, inside his head. Why did you want to go for that ironic tone? The book that it's based on is a straightforward investigative book.
Well, let's see. When the book reached us in 2001, I'd recently finished Aaron Brockovich, and Michael Mann's The Insider had come out in 1999. I think our sense was we needed to do something different, that just taking the standard approach wasn't really going to be exciting or fresh. And that's when we started thinking maybe we should try and do it as kind of a black comedy.
Matt, when you decided to take the part, did you want to meet the real Mark Whitaker or read the book, look at the court transcripts? Like, how much of this was about authenticity to you, since the tone wasn't quite the tone of the book? The question of authenticity, I think, is a difficult one, since you weren't being completely true to the tone of the story. You were altering that, and also kind of getting inside the mind of the character without knowing for sure what was going on in the mind of the character.
Right. Once Steven made the decision to shift the tone, it became unnecessary to meet Mark, and kind of inappropriate to meet him. I had originally thought I'd go down and see him. He was in prison at the time, and I was going to go go visit him, and but it just became it wasn't about doing a rigorous character study at that point. It was about trying to make something that was more like a, as Stephen called it, more like a subjective fever dream. So I actually have another movie coming out in a few months where I play a real person, and I prepared for the role completely differently and was spent a lot of time with the guy. So it was more about the tone of the. Of this movie that kind of determined how I'd prepare for it.
The character that you play, Matt Damon, who's based on a real character, Mark Whitaker, who was the whistleblower on ADM and a price-fixing conspiracy, he once he decides to talk to the FBI and wear a wire, part of that process drives him crazy, but part of the process is really seductive to him. Because, you know, he's seen the movie, he's seen The Firm, he's watched the James Bond films, he kids that he's 0014 because he's twice as good as 007. Since you've been in a series of spy films, the Bourne Identity films, what was it like for you to play somebody who wants to be that character and isn't?
it was a lot of fun. It was you know, the opposite of doing the Bourne movies. Yeah, I think it was always something that I thought was interesting about the character, that he did enjoy. You know, he did see himself as embroiled in the middle of this this drama, and he did constantly refer to Michael Crichton novels, and the character actually became addicted to the movie The Firm and saw himself as Tom Cruise in The Firm, and he would go and he would tell his wife he was going one place, and he'd go back to the multiplex and sit there and watch The Firm. So there is that aspect of the character that was enjoying the work that he was doing. But on the other hand, he was taking extraordinary risks. He was doing really courageous things, gathering all this evidence. But ultimately, his lawyer, one of the defenses they used was, look, these FBI agents go out and do undercover work, and they're trained for it, and they crack. And here's a guy with absolutely no training who went out there for 2.5 years and you know, obviously, when he was diagnosed as being bipolar, they realized that all of this pressure that he was under was just exacerbating that, and he started to deteriorate, you know, pretty quickly by the end.
Can you talk a little bit about how you stand or walk or move differently as Jason Bourne in a genuine spy thriller and as Mark Whitaker in The Informant, somebody who is an executive at ADM but is wearing a wire and really wants to be the spy kind of thriller person, but isn't.
Yeah, to me, the whole, you know, the way you walk and the way you stand and the way you sit, those are things I think a lot about, and always come out of hours and hours and hours of whatever kind of training or research I'm doing. In the case of the Bourne movies, one of the examples I use is. That character always stands angled off on whoever he's talking to, because the guy who was teaching me how to handle all these weapons out in the desert in L.A. was a former SWAT shotgunner, and he always stood angled off to me. And I realized it after I'd spent like a couple hundred hours with him, and I said, why are you always standing like that? I mean, is it to present less of an angle or something? He said, well, it's that, but really I just do it out of habit because I wear my gun on this hip and I always keep my body between whoever I'm talking to and my gun. So there, I'm convinced that there are thousands of little things like that that are signals that, you know, when you look at a movie and sometimes you walk out and I'll say to someone, hey, did you like that performance of that, you know, whatever actor? And a lot of times somebody will say, yeah, no, I didn't, not really. And I'd say, well, why? And they, I don't know. I just and they can't quite put their finger on it. But I'm convinced that there are hundreds of little details and little signals that you're sending to somebody who's watching the performance that add up to make a performance believable or not. And so I geek out on that stuff all the time and think about that stuff. And in the case of this movie, putting on the weight and a bunch of the external things really help. The wardrobe, the wig I was wearing, the mustache. I had plumping things in my cheeks that the dentist made for me, a nose thing on the end of my nose, because Stephen was convinced that the character shouldn't have any hard edges at all. He should look kind of hard to define, hard to pin down. And when your body changes and you feel clothes hitting certain parts of your body they don't normally hit, and it just it just affects everything. It's like a kind of a way to immerse yourself into that other guy.
So if in The Bourne Identity you stood at an angle when talking to people to separate your gun, to put your body between your gun and the person you're talking to, how did you stand as Mark Whitaker in The Informant when you were talking
straight,
to people?
Just right, straight facing somebody, like a guy who's got nothing to hide.
What kind of conversations do you have with each other when you're making a film? Like, Steven Soderbergh, do you give a lot of directions to the actors? Do you have conversations about motivation and that kind of stuff?
Boy, you know, I try not to.
Why not? Honestly,
I don't want anybody. I don't want an actor. It sounds terrible. I don't want them thinking. I want them just behaving the way the character would.
And wait. But Matt Damon said he kind of geeks out on the details.
That's,
thinking
well,
about.
You're preparing so that when you're in the moment, you're responding as the character would respond. But it's been my experience that when you can give an actor practical things to do, physical things to do, that really helps them lock in to the character. And I really don't like to engage in philosophical conversations while we're shooting, because I feel like it puts them in their head, and I don't want them in their head.
That's exactly right. From an actor's perspective too, that's exactly right. And the things that I geek out over, it's just when I'm thinking about it, it's a totally different stage of the of the whole deal. When it's happening, you need practical. You know, in fact, I'm working with a first-time director right now, and I jokingly told him that he was on a shot clock. That if he can't say it in 15 seconds, I just start hearing white noise. Now, if you want to have philosophical conversations, that's great, and I'll go out to dinner with you in pre-production, and we can talk for hours and hours and hours. And sometimes that's really helpful and good, and talk about thematically what's happening, and you know, all that's great. But when shooting a movie is a very different kind of stage of the process. And to talk about Steven's direction for a second, I would say, it's how I feel about a bunch of the directors I've worked with who all work very differently. But like with Gus Van Sant or Clint Eastwood or Francis, like their direction is always necessary and helpful. So they don't give me any more direction than I need. But like an example would be in this movie, there's a scene where I apologize, and I'm in court, and I apologize to the community, and I apologize to all of these people right before I'm sentenced. And on the first take, I did it as I thought he would have done it. It was this very heartfelt apology. And Steven said cut, and he came over, and he just sat down next to me and went, no. And I said, what do you mean? I thought that was really, that was honest. That I felt something there that felt pretty real. And he goes, oh, no, it was good. He said, it's just in the wrong movie. The tone of this movie was so specific that all the actors were really relying on Steven to kind of have the view from 30,000 feet at all times, because we can get lost in a moment or in a scene and go off the rails pretty quickly. And that's what had happened to me. And so So I said, okay, well, all right, what do I do? And he thought it for a second, and then he said, do it like an awards acceptance speech. And that was it, and that was my direction. And it's brilliant direction, and it's why I love working with him, and why I've gone back to work with, you know, Gus and Francis, and I'm going to go back and work with Clint again. It's the best ally you can have. You know, I have such trust in somebody who can give me a perfect piece of direction that, you know, doesn't bog me down, that doesn't take me out of it, but just basically is utterly helpful.
Steven, what made you think of an awards acceptance speech as being like the right tone?
I guess it's because I knew that part of him liked standing up and having everyone look at him and listen to him, that he liked that kind of attention. And so I wanted to have a sense of that, of the pleasure of that. And it contributes to the fact that he's often disconnected from the context in which he's operating. You're always trying to find the right metaphor to give somebody an idea. And for some reason, I thought of him standing up there sort of with an Oscar in his hand. And what would that sound like?
let me take you on a tangent for a second, Matt Damon. You did one of the really funny videos. This is really one of the funnier moments of recent TV history, I think. It was a video that Sarah Silverman made for the Jimmy Kimmel Show. And at the time this was on, they were a couple. I don't know if they still are. Anyway, so she comes on his show and says, I have something very, very important to tell you. And then it cuts to this video. And the video is her saying, I am blanking Matt Damon. I can't say the word, but you'll get what it is. It's a word I can't say on the radio. I'm blanking Matt Damon. And then it cuts to you, and you're there looking very, very handsome on the couch. And you say, yes, she is blanking Matt Damon. And then it goes into this whole kind of song and dance video thing. And, you know, there's like parodies of like hip-hop dance videos and, you know, like love scenes from videos. How did Matt Damon become the person who she wanted to brag to her boyfriend Jimmy Kimmel that she was blanking?
Well, it started, there's been a kind of a running joke with Jimmy and me, and I don't know how he picked me. He told me that he does this thing at the end of his show where he says, my apologies to Matt Damon, we ran out of time. And it's this running joke that I'm sitting waiting to come on, but I was basically bumped by whatever guests he has on the show that night.
Which is something that typically happens to up-and-coming people or the writer
who's
been on the end of the show, or the unknown comic. Yeah.
Exactly. And they end up doing an extra segment with one of the people, you know, one of their headliners, and that guy gets bumped. And so it started because he had such a depressing show one night. He said, I had like a ventriloquist and a guy in a gorilla suit. And, you know, it was one of those shows where I had this feeling like nobody was watching. And just as a kind of a throwaway at the end of his, you know, when he was saying goodnight, everybody, he said, my apologies to Matt Damon. You know, we ran out of time. And his producer, who was standing by on the other side of the camera, just doubled over laughing. And so he just started doing it every night because the two of those guys thought it was really funny. And then it kind of took on a life of its own. I started to hear about it. People came up to me, you know, what's the deal with you? Did you really get bumped from, you know, Jimmy Kimmel? And I knew what it was. I mean, I knew what it was. I watched him and I saw him do it. I thought, oh, that's a really funny idea. So Sarah called with this idea of, because, you know, that, you know, she was his girlfriend that, originally was going to take this. The show was originally going to, it was going to air on his, what was going to be his 40th birthday party. But the writer's strike happened and it ended up being done at a different time. But basically, I mean, I can take absolutely no credit for that, you know, video. It was a great idea that they had and that Sarah showed up in Miami. We shot it in like 2 hours because I had to go to a parent-teacher conference. And I wasn't expecting it to have even that much production value. I got there at 7 a.m. and they had, you know, red jumpsuits and backup dancers. And I was like, oh, okay, this is funny. So, it was basically just, I was the beneficiary of some very funny people doing some really good writing.
You both had success when you were very young. Steven Soderbergh, when you won, when Sex, Lies, and Videotape won the Cannes Film Festival top award, you were the youngest person ever to win that, the youngest director. And Matt Damon, you were in your 20s when you got the Oscar for Best Screenplay.
Affleck was younger than me, though, so he's the youngest screenwriter.
Right. So I guess I'm curious how what you think you want out of life and work has changed since having that young success, you know, now that you've actually had a lot more experience.
I think we both just want to try and win more awards.
That's what drives us.
Absolutely.
No, I think speaking for myself, I think the danger is always that you get frozen in the moment of your success because you're afraid that it's going to go away. And I looked at it as just an opportunity that the sort of crazy luck that we had was going to present me with the opportunity to explore a little bit, and I tried to take advantage of it, and I've continued to try and take advantage of it. And so early on, I think because I'd read a lot about the careers of other artists, not just filmmakers, the artists that I admired the most kept evolving and adapting. And so, you know, I felt that's, you know, in a weird sort of way, the only safe thing is to take a chance.
Interesting. Okay. Well, listen, good luck with the new movie and everything else. And I really want to thank you both so much for talking with us. Matt Damon, Steven Soderbergh, thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Matt Damon stars in the new film, The Informant. It's directed by Steven Soderbergh. The Informant opens this weekend. Here's music from the soundtrack composed by Marvin Hamlisch. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Steve Healy, is a comedy writer who has worked on Late Night with David Letterman, American Dad, and now writes for 30 Rock. His new book is a satirical novel about best-selling books. The main character is a young man who tries to figure out the formula for writing a best-selling novel so that he can show up his ex-girlfriend and so that he can issue pronouncements like, a writer makes it his duty to be midwife and doctor to an idea being birthed. The bestsellers Healy created for his novel sound like the real thing, like this one, Caesar, CEO, Business Secrets of the Ancient Romans. Steve Healy, welcome to Fresh Air. Why did you want to write a book about bad books?
Well, I like going to bookstores, and I'm always just taken aback and awed by the sheer number of books that come out every year and that are lining the shelves of bookstores. And I love just like rifling through them and finding the weird, crazy books. And each one represents some person's fanatic interest. And it takes a lot of energy and effort to write a book. And there are so many of them, and so many of them are so crazy that I thought it would be fun to write a book that sort of played with the idea of people who are writing these books and authors trying to invent this version of themselves and people trying to write books, maybe not for the best motives, and whether there's a difference between people who are trying to do it for the sort of noble motives of art and whether it's possible to sort of fake your way into that and come up with a book just sort of with the most crass and commercial motives possible.
And the latter is what your author tries to do. He has ulterior
motives. Yeah, exactly. He's interested in money and fame and humiliating his enemies.
Exactly.
And whether it's possible to sort of bluff your way into writing something that people could consider good.
Okay, let's start with the title that he comes up with, The Tornado Ashes Club. What is the title meant to communicate? Because everything he writes is meant to sell this book.
Right. Well, he makes a study of the bestseller list. The main character makes a study of the New York Times bestseller list, and he discovers that there are a lot of common tropes and things that seem to be in popular sort of literary books. And one of them is like clubs, people who are in clubs. One of them is natural disasters, sort of sweeping American landscapes, long journeys. And he compresses all these things into a crazy, wild narrative that involves people trying to throw the ashes of his grandmother's long dead lover into a tornado, which seemed like the most to him seems like the most sort of poetically ridiculous image he can come up with.
To more fully describe the book, let me read the blurb that the writer writes, hoping that this will be the bestseller blurb. Love, loss, and the soul of truth are explored when a wrongly accused man goes on a road trip with his grandmother and an American folk singer.
Exactly, yeah. Although later his editor changes the American folk singer into a ranchera singer, a singer of ranchera music, because she thinks that might appeal to his, sort of his Hispanic market.
He has a lot of rules. Your author has a lot of rules he came up with for creating a best-selling novel. As you mentioned, you know, have the word club.
Yeah, you've got to have
a story.
Club.
It's got to be a club or a mysterious secret society, shy characters, surprising love affairs. Also, the novel must have scenes on highways, making driving seem poetic and magical. Why is that important?
Well, he wants to tap into the audio, to the rich audiobook market. So he's got to have scenes that make people who are driving feel like they're being included in this lyrical, mythic journey across America's rugged landscape, even if they're just driving to Costco.
It has to involve music, which you have through the American folk singer.
Right, exactly, yeah, because a lot of bookstores are also selling music, so, you know, there's possibilities for crossover, a movie soundtrack. The fake author of this book is targeting a multi-platform media distribution landscape. He's very savvy about how he's going to sell things.
At dull points include descriptions of delicious meals.
I find when I'm reading, I'm always usually hungry, and, like, as long as I'm reading, I'm always also thinking about getting up to get a sandwich. And so if a book is sort of like stimulating that sense, it'll probably keep you going a little bit longer than it might otherwise.
And finally, the prose must be lyrical. And how do you define lyrical?
Lyrical is means resembling bad poetry, as far as this guy can figure out. So it should be easy enough for him to do. And he does a little practice.
Well, give us a taste of the novel that your fictitious novelist write, hoping it will become a bestseller and following all the rules that he came up with.
There's an excerpt at the beginning of the book. Away from them, across the field of low Durham wheat, they saw Evangeline's frame outlined pale in shadow against the highway sky as it trembled. "That's the way it is with a song, isn't it?" she said. "The way it quivers in your heart, quivers like the wings of a little bird. In a story, too." He spoke it softly in a voice that let her know how close they were. "That's the way it is with a story. Turns your heart into a bird."
Oh, God, I love it. This is something that your author doesn't mention as one of his rules, but to talk about the magic of the story is also a really important thing in some bestsellers.
Right, exactly. Well, the strange thing is that, of course, that is true. People do love stories, and,
exactly.
and stories grip people, and people get excited about them. But, of course, authors and writers and people who are interested in stories often sort of get hyperbolic in talking about how powerful and evocative these things are. And it just seemed fun to play with that idea of a guy who's sort of faking it, and he's coming up with this totally crap story that means nothing to him, but trying to present it as this sort of like transformative, mythic, religious experience, and hoping he can bluff people into believing it.
So when you were writing this book and going to a lot of bookstores and seeing a lot of books that struck you as really crazy or merely bad, did you start keeping a notebook of particularly purple phrases that you'd come up with, or stock phrases that seemed to be recurring in a lot of different novels?
Yeah, it seemed like lyrical. The word lyrical appears on the back cover of almost every sort of work of literary fiction. And sometimes it's accurate and means that the prose is like incredibly musical and falls lightly on the ear. And sometimes it just sort of means that like there are going to be a lot of adjectives and it's sort of crazy writing. And the simplest act of every author is described in the most sort of luscious purple prose possible. So that seemed like a pretty key one to hit. But I was also sort of focusing on what story elements seem to be really popular. The amount of murders that occur on the New York Times bestseller list is just incredible. Very few books get on the New York Times bestseller list unless someone has gotten murdered in them. This is true of TV shows, too, and movies as well. People love reading about murders.
So you had to put a murder in the novel within the novel?
Yeah, of course. You've got to have one.
You know, your writer writes his outline for the novel, and he ends with, "A stunning literary debut told with lyrical prose." Check. gentle humor and an artist's eye. The Tornado Ashes Club is a novel for anyone who's had love or lost it, learned a wise lesson or a dark secret, or felt the magic of the story that is America. That's so great.
that is, you know, this guy is sort of basically just trying to write the purplest description he can and nails it.
Who hasn't had love or lost it or learned a wise lesson or a dark secret?
Felt the story that is America.
The story of the magic that is America. But that's another thing that he thinks is key, you know, talking about like the magic of America. Why does he think that's important to include in the book?
Somehow that seems like a very popular and recurring theme in American fiction, and especially popular American fiction, that it often takes place in some rugged or strange place. It's strange to, you know, the people like you and I that work on the media and, you know, sort of fetishize West Virginia and Western Texas and the plains of Montana, although we don't bother living there. But we sort of romanticize it. And I think there's a sort of hunger for that authenticity among people who are sort of looking for experiences in books and doing a lot of reading, who sort of crave that idea of the American wilds. And there is something magical about it. This guy doesn't know anything. He's living in, you know, suburban Boston, doesn't know what he's talking about. But he knows that is a thing that people crave when they're reading books. And he crams it in there as much as possible.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Steve Healy. And he's written a new really funny satirical novel about the book world, which is called How I Became a Famous Novelist. Healy has also written for David Letterman, for American Dad, and now he writes for 30 Rock. In your novel, How I Became a Famous Novelist, you come up with your own bestseller list. I'm going to ask you to read a few of the fiction and nonfiction entries on the bestseller list that you wrote for the book.
Sure. The New York Times bestseller list is a just great piece of writing. They always have these terrific summaries of books that are obviously very weird and oftentimes difficult to summarize, and it's just an amazing kind of poetry that I love reading every week. So here's some of my fake ones. Mind Stretch, Trang Martinez suspects her Pilates instructor may also be a vicious serial killer. Great Fish, the biblical story of Jonah retold from the point of view of the whale. Kindness to Birds. On a journey across the Midwest, a downsized factory worker named Gabriel touches the lives of several people wounded by life. Expense the Burberry. A young woman in Manhattan spends her days testing luxury goods and her nights partying and complaining. So those would be some fiction. Here's a couple nonfiction. Cracked Like Teeth, a memoir of petty crime, drunken brawls, and recovery by a writer who was addicted to paint thinner by age 9. Empanadas in Worcester. Traveling from Khartoum to Madras to Rhode Island, a commentator for CNN suggests globalization means a stranger but friendlier world in the 21st century. Bonds Sealed in Freedom, an account of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, focusing on the friendship of Washington, Jefferson, and a little-known Philadelphia orphan.
I love it. I know I've read these books.
you may have had them on.
I may have had them on. The bestseller list usually also reflects the culture wars, because you've got the books from the left and the books from the right, and they're always vying for the top spots.
So, oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So you've come up with like your right-wing author, Donnie Weber. Tell us about him.
Oh, yeah. He's sort of a radio host main character of my book listens to on the way to work, just to sort of try and stimulate some emotional excitement in him. And he's a radical. He wrote a book called Tax the Jihadis that talks about how he wants to deport illegal immigrants to Iran and see how they like it. And sort of our main character listens to right-wing talk radio, as I and some people I know have, to sort of it's just a way of like sort of getting yourself worked up emotionally. And gradually, as he becomes emotionally deadened, he realizes that even this isn't doing it for him anymore. He just can't get worked up, and he becomes more and more indifferent.
You're getting interviewed right now, and I'm sure you've been doing, you know, a bunch of interviews for your new book, as authors always hope to do in order to get the word out about their book. So did you study book interviews both to write your book and also to like perform after the book was published?
I have studied book interviews. I love reading interviews with authors because they are always terrific. I think the interview that Cormac McCarthy gave with Oprah is one of the most amazing pieces of television that has ever occurred. I mean, one of the first questions asked Cormac McCarthy is, you know, there aren't a lot of women in your books. And Cormac McCarthy just looks at her and goes, I've never met a woman that I understood. And it's just, this is just an absurd meeting of American culture, two geniuses who are trying to have a conversation with each other. But yeah, you know, I have studied author interviews. There are a lot of authors who are great at presenting an image of themselves, which is awesome and incredible. They come up with the best character possible is themselves. I feel like I'm going to make my life a lot easier if I just tell you the truth as best as I can.
Preston Brooks, who's the best-selling novelist, who's the kind of part model, part rival for the writer in your novel, he says, and I think this is, if I remember correctly, this is in an interview, he says, I found a tattered copy of Mice and Men, maybe from an angel's hand, maybe just a lazy schoolboy, but I read it, and John Steinbeck showed me that there was stronger stuff than whiskey.
Right. This is from a moment in the book where so Pete Tarsall, the main character, is watching this interview on TV and seeing this guy, and he can't believe the just reams of garbage that's coming out of his mouth, the absurd statements that he's saying, and he's thinking to himself, oh, I could totally pretend to be that guy. And part of the story of this book is it possible to pretend to be something you're not in order to become really successful? Can you bluff your way into this? And some you read interviews with authors and you wonder how much of it is true and how much is fake. I love the author Mark Helprin. I don't know him. I've never met him. All I know about him is what I read in interviews. And his interviews are crazy. He just wrote this book called Digital Barbarism, where he's sort of responding to people who criticize him on the Internet. And it includes so many remarkable just sort of cast off passages about his own life, which I don't know if they're true or false. But he talks about, you know, when I was 14, I went off on a bike ride across the United States. He talks about these encounters he had with corn farmers and stuff. Now, maybe this is all true. I don't know. But certainly he's presenting an image of Mark Helprin, which is awesome and admirable, and which you want to you want to know more about this guy. So I think that there are, whether they're fake or real is part of the fun of figuring it all out.
Now, your previous book, which you co-authored, was called The Ridiculous Race.
Describe
the premise of that book.
This was another television writer, a friend of mine named Vali Chandrasekharan, and I had an idea to have a race around the world in opposite directions without using airplanes. We were both living in L.A. at the time, and we agreed that I would go west and he would go east, and we would circumnavigate the globe without using airplanes, and the first guy to get back to L.A. from the opposite direction would win an expensive bottle of scotch. And we set off to do this journey, and I went around the world without using airplanes. I did not get back to Los Angeles first. However, I still consider myself the winner and had a lot of adventures along the way in China and Mongolia and the Pacific Ocean and so forth. And Vali had his own set of adventures too, and hopefully the book is funny and entertaining and people will enjoy it.
Now, I have to tell you, that's a genre of book that I tend to really dislike. I consider it like the pointless exercise designed for the sole purpose of getting a book contract to carry out the pointless exercise.
Oh, well, it was absolutely a pointless exercise. We absolutely just wanted to do it. We were lucky enough to find a publisher that would sort of fund us to do it. And sort of as our part of the bargain, we wrote a book that we hope is funny and entertaining to readers. And I think, you know, it should basically even out. But I absolutely confess to it being a pointless act that we just wanted to have a race around the world.
Now, I want to read an explanation you gave of how the race began. You wrote, "It was at the Magnificence Consortium, a society I'd founded. The members, myself, Vali, and our delightful young associate, Layla, met weekly for the purposes of wearing preposterous suits, inventing cocktails, attempting to cook forgotten foods of the 1920s, drinking wine from the 99-cent store, sampling expired medicines, and proposing toasts to one another." And I wasn't sure if that was for real or not, because in that you have some of the elements that the writer in your novel decides has to be included in any book to be a bestseller. You have a society, you know, a club.
Yeah, absolutely.
You have like food, you know, like forgotten foods of the 1920s, recipes
right.
of forgotten foods.
I tell you that all of that is true. Most of the foods from the 1920s were supplied by the one lady in the society. Vali and I can't cook at all. But all of those things did occur. They did really happen. And I won't deny that we were definitely pretending to be more awesome than we were, but we did do these things. So I can vouch for that being 100% true.
Why did you have a Magnificence Consortium, a little society? And why do you see it as something to be satirized now? You know, all the books that actually have, you know, clubs or societies.
Well, people love clubs. There's a reason why people form them and people have them. I have nothing against clubs. I've been part of quite a few awesome ones, and I'm proud of them. And there's no... And book clubs are certainly a big way to get books across in a way that people talk about and love books. Now, if you were an absolutely cynical person and you wanted to and if all you were thinking about is how to make your book popular, then you'd certainly want to appeal to book clubs, because those are groups of 10 and 15 people who are going to buy books. And you'd also want to appeal to people who were reading on their own and sort of dream of being a part of a cool club. Now, I was lucky enough to live with my friends, and we formed this little society, which was short-lived because it was so ridiculous. But we did form it, and it did exist. And I despite any satire, I endorse clubs and encourage people to join and found them.
Well, how did you break into television? I know you edited the Harvard Lampoon. When you were
yes, I was president of the Harvard Lampoon, and then I, after graduating college, I sort of just sat around my parents' house and worked and just tried to write samples of packets for television shows. This is how you sort of just write a sample of the shows that you like, and I wrote a bunch and tried to get hired on different shows, and then sort of through a lucky break, I was able to find someone who would send my packet to The Late Show with David Letterman, and they liked what I'd written, and I got a job interview there, and then I didn't hear back from them for 2 months, and I moved to Los Angeles to try and look for work there, and then immediately on arriving in Los Angeles, I got a job and had to move back to New York to work on Letterman.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Did you do 10 best lists?
I did write top 10 lists, yeah. And sometimes we would get home. It's the most fun of working on that job was that sometimes we would write a top 10 list, and then we'd stay at work late, and, you know, it would be 11:30 or so, and we'd be going home in a cab, and the cabbies would be listening to the top 10 list on the radio, which is always fun to actually hear someone enjoying the work you'd just done that day.
Did you write top 10 lists for politicians? Sometimes Hillary would come on and do her top 10 list, which I always assume the writers wrote.
Yeah, so I don't remember any politicians when I was there. I'm sure there were some. I remember one really fun one we wrote was like we had to write a top 10 list, but there was going to be a team of Army, you know, Special Forces guys rappelling off the roof of the Ed Sullivan Theater, the 14th floor of the Ed Sullivan Theater, and we had to write things for them to yell as they were rappelling off the roof. I don't remember all the good ones, but it was fun to write for those guys. I remember – I don't even know if I wrote this joke, but I just remember an Army paratrooper jumping off the roof of the Ed Sullivan Theater yelling, "Dude, you're getting Adele!" And just rappelling down the side of 14th Street, 54th Street.
And you've also written for American Dad, which is an animated series. What's it like to write for cartoon characters as opposed to people?
Oh, it's great because it's a lot easier than dealing with actors because it's you know, you can have them record it 50, 60 times and it's not that stressful for them. And you can manipulate the sets a lot more easily. There's no physical restrictions. You can move people around and have them in different countries and invent new characters whenever you want. And all you have to do is find a voice to supply it. And there's also a long time lag in the time between you write something and when the actual cartoon appears on the air. So when you're working on a late night show like Letterman, for instance, there's people running around in costumes and you have to get stuff done in 5 minutes and you got to run it down to the stage and it's frantic and show busy. And working on an animated show is a lot more relaxed because, you know, you write something and then it's going to take 9 months for someone to draw it and process it and color it and get it all back. So it was a little more laid back.
You've been writing for 30 Rock since June. So this is your first period. We haven't seen any of your shows yet, right?
Yes, I just started working there. I can't take credit for any of the genius that they've already done, but I'm excited to be a part of that team.
So what's it like when you join a show that's already in progress? Is there like...
There's brutal, absolutely brutal hazing. It's merciless. No, it's a little weird because there are people there, you know, who've been there since the beginning and they've gotten down the voice of the show and they've figured out how to work with each other and they know what they're doing and they know what works and what doesn't. And you sort of have to figure that out very quickly on the job and hopefully make a contribution. But it's tough. And especially a show like 30 Rock that, you know, has set the bar for comedy brilliance. You really want to bring your A game and do your best.
Let's get back to your novel a second, your satire.
Sure.
About the literary world and about somebody who tries to be a best-selling writer. You know, and he knows, that when it comes time to be interviewed for his book, he could present this super awesome version of himself.
Exactly,
You know, to help interest people in him and his book. So if you were taking your life... The best version of your life. Version of yourself.
I was a younger child, and I always had to struggle for attention my whole life, and I scrappily managed to work my way through the town of Needham Park and Recreation System, slaving away at the town pool in the bowels of misery. But through there, I found comedy offered me a way out, and I worked my way up to Harvard, where I got on the Harvard Lampoon and showed those rich kids what was what. With my witty satire, I entered the circles of the aristocrats, and from there, I managed to break into Hollywood. But soon I found that Hollywood disgusted me with its deplorable silicon lifestyle and values degraded by wealth and pools. And so I came back to New York City, the only place where a writer could be. And I took on the publishing world. And there are towers on 14th Street, sorting out America's literary world. I told them that I would show the emperor had no clothes. And so I've done with How I Became a Famous Novelist. And I don't intend to rest until I've destroyed the entire facade of American publishing and shown it for what it truly is.
And now you can make it in Hollywood, too, because the book has been optioned. Your book has been optioned.
It's true. Yes. Now finally I'll go back and I'll put it on the big screen. Although, of course, those bastards in Hollywood will probably tear it apart and put a happy ending on it and ruin everything. But I needed the money for my whiskey and women. Is that the version?
Very good, very good.
Unfortunately, I've found that it is tiresome to pretend to be a character, although very fun.
Well, Steve Healy, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for talking with us. It's been really fun, and
sure, my pleasure.
I really enjoyed your novel, so thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Steve Healy is the author of the new satirical novel, How I Became a Famous Novelist. He also writes for 30 Rock. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.